Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Aliotto.
And there's no guest today. You're stuck with us. But we'll be talking about a few things that have been on our minds and in the news. I would like to start by saying I had a really moving experience this morning. I went out to the local bakery in my neighborhood. They're closed on Mondays, so I tend to go on Tuesday morning to get a nice loaf of bread for my week. And I got a loaf of sourdough rye sandwich shape loaf.
Really good choice.
Still hot from the oven. And I walked home. It's this kind of fall morning. I'm holding it to my chest. It was like the warmth of a child.
Or I was going to say like fatherhood. That. Here I come.
Yeah. I don't know. It was a really beautiful moment. Just wanted to share that.
That is a beautiful moment. I liked that a lot. A lot of times it's my little morning jaunt is like two iced coffees. And so it's like walking home with
both for you?
Very cold baby in each hand.
That's horrible. Nobody wants to. What?
No, it's just not the same. But one of them's usually for Ben.
Okay.
So
okay. I wasn't sure if you were like preparing for your.
I usually ask for a tray, but now I have extra trays at my house. So I've been trying to remember to bring my tray.
Trying to remember. So you've been stockpiling more trays and saying that you.
Basically, won't. I put it next to the door and I still forgot it.
Okay, let's talk about farming. We didn't really talk about this piece that a couple of weeks ago you published in Dirt, a piece I wrote about both my own decision not to take over my family farm, as well as the disappearance of family farms, of small farms rather, which are typically family farms in this country. I believe the stat was since the turn of the century, we've lost 13.2% of small farms in this country, which is 286,780. I was inspired to write this after reading about Smallholds bankruptcy. Adam DeMartino, co-founder, and I believe he was CTO, was his role there at Smallhold. But last year they went bankrupt. And when I had first learned about Smallhold, like 5-6 years ago, I was fascinated by what seemed to be a profitable farm where you could make a good living, but you could still produce produce and these kind of values that I grew up with, right? But it turns out that at the end of the day, despite all the VC cash that they raised, it was still a mushroom farm that was not quite profitable enough or scalable enough to justify venture investment. Related to that, I've just recently read this article about farmers really in the Hudson Valley, Catskills region. A nice stat from this. This was in the New York Times a month or two ago. To quote here, in Sullivan County, the latest census data show that of the 749 producers reported, 36% were new and beginning farmers. And then they spoke to farmers here of all ages, all backgrounds. And there was kind of one who was like more of the traditional farming route, descent, like third generation farmer. And then a couple newer, like sort of neo hippie back to the land farmers. And I think that piece was more optimistic, where mine was maybe a little more pessimistic. I don't know if mine was so pessimistic, but it was like, I think where I left the reader was that, specifically where I leave it is I talk about my parents trying to sell their farm and how it will be difficult for them to find somebody with the right mix of skills, value, and capital. Mm. And what I'm implying is you can't really, nobody has all three, right? Pick two or even just one.
Yeah.
But I think
I should have done a you pick two triangle graphic.
You pick like the blueberries, you pick too. But this New York Times one, I think they found people who had the capital and the value and were like very actively learning the skills. Yeah. But I think it also kind of proves that point where like you might have two, but you have to find the third. You might have the skills and the values. You're going to have to find the capital and that's going to be very hard.
Right. Also, like this idea that farming is either a subsistence business for people born into it or the hobby of somebody after they become rich.
Mm-hmm. One of the guys in this article was like a former financier in New York and yeah, made a bunch of money and then could do this without the crushing.
It's like Marie Antoinette being like, build me a small village where I can pretend that I have sheep. But I understand, like, I think people are doing it out of deeply held values and a desire to be closer to nature. And I don't judge that.
No, not at
all. I just think if those people were succeeding disproportionately, it could conceal a lot of the issues facing people doing it for subsistence, but they probably fail at the same rate, if not higher. Mm-hmm. Okay. Your parents don't do soybeans.
No, that is far from it. I feel like I don't know the exact economics behind soybeans, but from what I understand, if you're doing soybeans, first, you're probably in the Midwest, and second, you're probably farming hundreds of acres.
Well, the economics are China's supposed to buy them. They're not buying them. It's a retaliatory measure. And so they're buying Argentinian soybeans, but Argentina is still bad. So we're also simultaneously bailing Argentina out to prop up their more sort of capitalist president.
Mm. And Jay, I believe his name
so
is.
We're basically subsidizing the soybeans that are being sold to China instead of our soybeans. And the government's going to have to bail everyone out anyway.
Sort of a beautiful own goal.
It is an Ouroboros of stupidity. I saw that report.
I'm absolutely soy facing. You can't see this at home, listener. I'm absolutely soy facing.
They sniped a photo of the text message that I think who Treasury Secretary was getting from the Agriculture Secretary.
Yes, I saw this. Yeah.
Basically laying all of this out. But I mean, it's been this, all of this has been reported. I think it was just, that was the crash out. Not great.
Not great. Yeah, I don't, not that we have to go so deep into tariffs, and I don't know enough about this to speak eloquently about it, but I find it hard to believe that this isn't just going to end with like pie on face for a bunch of people. I guess the point is more about like a few specific people getting rich and not really about like re-energizing the manufacturing industry in America, right? But yeah, I'm not saying anything new here, but it just boggles my mind that we're like holding to these tariffs on soybean or just like these trade cutoffs.
I would like for people who grow soybeans in this country to feel like they can vote their self-interest and that those self-interests would align with my interests. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be at odds with the people that grow soybeans in this country.
I'm always saying that. I'm always saying that.
Because I think what they do is important, and I'm sure they don't think what I do is important. But this was all, I do believe this was all foreseeable. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if any of these tariffs are even real. So
yeah.
But this particular retaliatory measure is real. So
I 404 did this great story a month or so ago about how the end of the de minimis exception is like hurting anybody with like a niche hobby who buys stuff on eBay basically. Mm-hmm. And I was scrolling eBay the other day for Japanese ties, vintage Japanese ties.
No comment.
A friend was just in Japan and brought me back this nice tie. And I was like, oh, this is fun. I'm going to look at more of these. So anyways,
W. David Marks activity.
That is
have him tell him what you want and have him bring it when he comes for his book tour.
It's fair. He can order. I can order it to his house. He can bring it. No, the point is this tie was like $5 and then shipping was $250.
Oh,
I understand
my God,
that this is what they've done is like a bunch of these people in other countries that, you know, often are selling to the U.S. Have just made the shipping cost of anything $250.
Serenity mm-hmm. now. Well, I'm gearing up to do another zine with global contributors, and everyone gets two copies of the zine. Oh, but no. I'm like, who's going to be the most expensive person to send two copies of the zine to? I'm so excited to find out.
Because like, even if you're sending it as a gift, that it might get flagged.
Yeah, we'll see.
Certainly, if agents of the Postal Service are listening to this now.
My postal office added like another big thing about not shipping perfume, and like I
really?
For sure have shipped.
Is that a thing
there?
Because it's an aerosol, and it's
You have to deny your sending perfumes and aerosols. But let me tell you, I have shipped perfume in my life, and I have received perfume in my life.
I have bought it online.
Well, those people have a license. I don't, but that's okay.
Okay. Well, the thing I wanted to bring up, related somewhat to that New York Times Farm article, and really mine, where it's like, you know, some of these VC backed techno farms that were growing food weren't really like, that was never really what they were going to make their money off of. What they were going to make their money off of was tech, that they were using to grow their food, mm-hmm. specifically like Square Roots. They have these container farms
that was the Basil systems. Company.
The Basil Company, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then somewhat related, this New York Times article, there's people who like have a lodge that they rent out that you can go stay in, right? And maybe that makes more money than parts of the farm, or it's just a part of the overall revenue mix that makes it all work, right?
Mm-hmm. Or like weddings.
I bet
some of them make money on weddings.
Definitely, certainly.
So you have weddings on your farm? Are you going to get married there?
On my sister's farm.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, there you go. But I'm not paying for that. thank you to my loving sister. So I read this piece by Doug Shapiro, media consultant, writer, theorist guy, called What If All Media is Marketing Now? Which I would agree. I mean, that's kind of what I do for a living with Creator Spotlight.
I feel like that's all we talk about on this podcast.
That's all we talk about.
Talk it up, Doug. No, sorry.
But there's like a long, it's a really long article and well-researched, but he very graciously provides a TLDR at the beginning, which I will read one segment of this, which is he's basically talking about how Gen AI will oversaturate the market. It's going to be impossible to monetize with advertising or subscriptions. Sure, something we do often talk about, as you say. And I'm going to read two bits of this quick. What happens then? Here's a common pattern. When barriers collapse in a market, supply explodes, consumer price sensitivity increases, prices migrate toward marginal cost, and all the value shifts to the scarce complements. This has happened in markets as diverse as food, stock trading, digital photography, PCs, consumer electronics, and many others. In all cases, the commoditized product becomes a loss leader, customer acquisition cost, or at best, marginally profitable, and value shifts elsewhere. If the same pattern plays out in media, most content may cease to be a profit center. Instead, it will become top of funnel to something else. Media will become marketing. Last bit. To be clear, there's a difference between media sells marketing and media is marketing. Today, content is the product, and one way it monetizes is by renting out the attention it generates, selling advertising. In this new model, content is the cost, and the only sustainable profits will be for media companies to own the complements themselves. Or for the complements to own the media companies, if you will.
I mean, yeah, we see it with Semaphore, right? A large percentage of their business is events.
Yeah.
I was telling you off mic. Free. Mm-hmm. Is it?
They have, I think they have like a crazy high ticket executive cost newsletter, but like I'm subscribed to their daily, their tech newsletter, their media newsletter. These are all free. There's no paid version. You have a point to make. I'm going to look.
Well, I was telling you before we started about the piece in New York Magazine, I think by Charlotte Klein, about Cultured Magazine, and like mm-hmm. its reputation was always as almost like a vanity project. Although they've had advertisers like Chanel since the beginning, it was sort of like a Hamptons art mag was the reputation. I feel like they haven't always paid freelancers particularly well. But apparently they've had like in recent years a bit of a renaissance. They've hired mm-hmm. some really smart critics. They have like Cult 100 franchise that they did at the Guggenheim, that's bringing advertisers in. And I think that they have like a cultured club, which mm-hmm. is like a membership club, which is sort of what Doug is talking about, which made me think of this. I will say, like, I think this is an amazing business story for your magazine to have been around for more than 10 years and then like eventually achieve more profitability and really like crack whatever the ideal split between various revenue streams is. I will say I could not tell you a single thing that they've ever published. And I don't think it has to be either or, but it makes it hard for me to be like, okay, here's the replicable model where I'm like, what is the taste of this? What is the point of view of this magazine? Maybe it's not for me, but I care about everything that they cover. So I don't know. I think like it is an example though. Like if it had the reputation of being a vanity mag, it was sort of like vanity magazines are thought of as marketing for the person that started it or the company mm-hmm. that started it. Now it's like, well, all media is marketing. So I've definitely heard that thrown around less. But it seems it's like the substance of the business now is like these experiences, perhaps. And advertisers are interested in sponsoring them.
Yeah. I mean, I was looking, I think it was today or yesterday as we speak, it was published, Hellgate's annual report, which is, mm-hmm. I don't want to give away the whole thing here because it is behind the paywall, but two details I think are worth bringing up. One, they are mostly monetized through paid subscribers, which is sort of like a refutement of this conversation we're having, right? Mm-hmm. They said that they have 9,000 paid subscribers now as of the end of September 2025, which is a 69% increase from their previous annual report. They've been active for 3 years now. And they have $70,000 in monthly recurring revenue, which is up 66% from last year. At this time last year, they were at 42,000. And again, they are primarily funded by subscribers. They're also funded by philanthropy, ads, and public funding. But ads, they only sold $20,000 worth of ads over the last 12 months. So I think, I guess, why I bring this up is like the question of like, when is media not marketing, and like now and in the future? Like, cause you know, I think Doug Shapiro's piece is more like, this is a transition that's happening. But I feel like something like Hellgate will always, you know, will always be able to make money in this way because people want to support it because it's, they're doing reporting that they won't get elsewhere, and, or people want this thing to exist. And there's like that patronage aspect to media. I know, you know, my parents have long been like local radio station supporters. And when all that media funding was cut by the government at the beginning of the year, they upped their increase by like $100 a year or something like that. So I think this point that all media is marketing, like, I think this kind of like local media or like, you know,
local media has I think people perceive it as a public good in a way that magazines are not. I think magazines, like, to draw on a point that maybe I actually forget where I even made this point, if it was on this podcast or on Boys Club live stream, but like magazines, I think, do act as a check on the worst consumer impulses of the sort of like uncultured class. Mm-hmm. And maybe we sort of like that, we kind of forgot that until we lost it, that like magazines are supposed to, like, on the same way that like political journalism will check power, cultural magazines check the impulses of people that have cultural power, to say like, if you have a weird wedding, we're going to make fun of you. If you, you know what I mean? Like, if you're driving a weird car, we're going to make fun of you. Or if, you know, you're buying a new car and your company is being sued for discrimination, we're going to make fun of you. Mm-hmm. So there is that, like, it's not a public good in the same way that reporting on campaign finances, but there is some important dynamic to, doing almost like a controlled burn of what's happening in culture. And without that, like, platforms do the opposite, right? Like Paul Graham, everyone mm-hmm. knows Paul Graham is my emotional support libertarian, or my emotional support centrist, I think is what mm-hmm. I called him. You know, he's like, I don't know where he's been for the last 2 years, but yesterday he was like, something's deeply wrong with Twitter. And it's like, yeah, dude. Because I have a couple of accounts where I'm not following a lot of people, mm. including Dirt. So I kind of get just like the raw, whatever anyone's getting. And it is bad. They are deliberately showing the most divisive stuff. They are deliberately showing very cherry-picked racial crimes, violence from both sides. Mm-hmm. And it's not good. And so you have magazines, which, yes, there is sensationalism, you know, obviously like Inquirer or stuff that, like, in the grocery store, where it's like, you know, JonBenet Ramsey, she's alive. Like, yeah, not that stuff, but like, like a Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
Obviously they want to get attention, but they want to control the cultural conversation. Not let it be dominated by people with the most money and platforms. I think that the incentive is much different. It's success by division, where division breeds engagement. Mm-hmm. And I think that's messed up. And I think people are starting to realize like, hey, like we've sort of lost something here and can't put their finger on it. They see the media as part of it. They see the media as sowing division, but we have something
now. Are we talking about like to focus on like how what succeeds is polarizing? Do you think that is exclusive to Twitter, or is this true of like Instagram, of TikTok, of Blue Sky, say?
YouTube? I think TikTok's pretty messed up. I think Instagram and YouTube have more checks in place. Mm-hmm. I know Threads, you can't even talk about politics, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think all of their numbers are made up, though.
I agree. I know.
But because I've been like, mm-hmm. I think I've been creating Threads against my will, to be honest, because sometimes I forget to like untoggle.
You've been when creating I post it? On I've, Instagram. I don't think I've ever created a thread.
Well, you might I be do, without knowing
they,
it.
They get me sometimes, though, when they, in your Instagram feed, when they like show a thread, it'll be like some stupid... usually like a soccer thing.
Yeah. So if you click that by accident, you're probably in their numbers as a Threads user.
Certainly I am. I probably open it once a day in that way.
I don't blame them for trying to create an alternative. Just like I don't blame Substack for trying to create an alternative. Like my issue is replacing something that was fulfilling a very different function and then trying to convince everyone that this is better. Even people who don't like media or the idea of media as a fourth estate, if you ask them to come up with thought experiments for how to solve for the trustlessness of information in society, they will basically come up with the media again. They will reinvent it from scratch. They'll be like, well, we should call people and ask them what actually happened. And it's like, wow, yeah, we do. We should call people and ask them what actually happened.
Imagine that.
I also think I don't know if there's any books about this. I feel like there must be. Like, I would be very interested in the history of the opinion page and the opinion section and how it has both benefited and taken away from the role of the newspaper, because everyone has turned against this idea of the op-ed board or a newspaper making a presidential endorsement. At the same time, all you hear from people who are interested in sort of like new decentralized media is all about parasociality. It's all about commentary. It's all about opinion. And so if you can't graft that onto the traditional news product without destroying the credibility of the traditional news product, like where does that leave the news? Mm-hmm. And can the news and opinion exist separately, and have they ever existed separately?
I just tried to see if there's a book on the history of the opinion section.
We're gonna ask ChatGPT.
Maybe there is, but I specifically searched for, because I figured this would be the best proxy for it, if there was a book on the history of the New York Times opinion section. And what I did find is this piece from 2021 by Kathleen Kingsbury, the opinions editor of said Times, about why the New York Times is retiring the term op-ed, which if I knew this had ever happened, I did not know. But
I didn't know about that. You're just telling me that for the first time.
You tell me that for the first time. to scan a few details here. The first op-ed page in the New York Times was on September 21st, 1970. It was so named because it appeared opposite the editorial page, and not, as many still believe, because it would offer views contrary to the papers. Inevitably, it would do that too. Okay, it's time to change the name. The reason is simple. In the digital world, in which millions of Times readers absorb the paper's journalism online, there is no geographical op-ed, just as there is no geographical ed for op-ed to be opposite to. It is a relic of an older age and an older print newspaper design. So 50 years later, they're retiring it. Editorials will still be called editorials, but the articles written by outside writers will be known as guest essays. a title that will appear prominently above the headline. So I guess that, I mean, to there's a little bit more. It's not actually a very long piece here. The geography of the public square is being contested in many ways. That square is more representative. Everyone has an outlet, from Facebook to Substack to Twitter. This is 2021. Those are different things then. That is to be welcomed. What is disparaging, though, are voices, are spaces where voices can be heard and respected. Okay, enough of this. But I guess what's interesting to me here is that, it comes from this context where it's like, here's the facts, here's the editorial, and then here's people maybe railing against it, just some opinion that isn't necessarily like the truth. And then the like the make your own page of internet media consumption.
Grok, kind
of.
Is this true?
Grok, is this true? Grok Ed.
Oh, they're making Grokopedia. Did you see that?
No.
Yeah. There's an attempt.
I also read that the government signed some contract, federal government signed a contract with Grok.
Sure. Why not?
Anyways, speaking of magazines, I got the Metrograph, second issue of the Metrographs magazine.
Oh, bummer. Weekend. They offered me one of those. I forgot to respond. It's really beautiful, right?
It is nice. Yeah, it's really nice. Which I think it costs like $20. I don't know. I got it at Iconic Magazines on Kenmare. I think that's the name of that one. There's only one ad. There's only one ad.
Is it for Metrograph?
No, it's for Hermes on the back.
Okay, so they just sold the back cover to Hermes and said that's enough of that.
Yeah, no, I'm flipping through. I'm looking for more ads. I'm not seeing any more ads.
Well, I was going to tell you, so when you're talking about Hellgate, so that's like obviously more paid subscribers than I have, but I've already sold more than $20,000 worth of ads for next year. Mm-hmm. So it's just very different, like the models. And like, I think like everything that I've said, like in my essay about the future of media as a bank, like there's obviously carve outs to that. Like,
yeah.
Midcoast Villager is a great example. They're doing amazing, right? And I think what they're doing is super interesting. That's, people are always going to view spending on something like that differently from spending on a Vogue or...
Which is an indulgence as opposed to a necessity.
It's an indulgence, but an indulgence that plays an important role in our cultural ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that everyone's trying to drill down on.
I have something here. We were both at On Air,
I was there
conference
the morning, you were there for more of the afternoon.
Well, okay, so the final
shout out talk, to Ari, by the way, that was ridiculous, like
friend of the pod, former guest,
down boss. To the last detail, you guys, this was a cult. It was like a cult activation.
Okay, wait. So we should talk about all the details and how good a job Ari did. Flatter his ego here. But the last talk of the day was Shane Hegde, Air CEO, and Nicholas Thompson, CEO of The Atlantic, and Macy Gilliam, friend of the pod, from Morning Brew, famously. She asked him a really good question.
Was she on Creator? She been on Creator Spotlight?
No, but soon to come.
Okay. Yeah, we were sitting with her. We were all sitting in the same row, right?
We were. Yeah. Well, I was right behind you guys.
Macy had a very cool plaid outfit on, guys. So.
No, she did.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyways, she asked a great question. That was basically, what do you make of the fact that so much low quality information and even propaganda is freely available online, whereas something that is produced, that's very highly produced and more rigorously fact checked, etc., like The Atlantic, that is all behind a paywall and harder to access. The gist of her question. And Mr. Thompson gave a pretty good answer, I'd say, where, you know, he's basically saying, like, look, we have a bottom line. To produce that costs money. Subscriptions are one of the best ways for us to get that money. But, and I think this is the part, again, longer answer, but this is the part that stuck with me, is that they've been experimenting with like, what's the loosest paywall we can do that still drives people to sign up and still allows us to make enough money to keep producing this journalism. And I think there was a lot of like AI conversation, and he was talking about how there's some way they're implementing AI to test the loosest possible paywall, which I guess is technology beyond what I'm working with in a day-to-day.
The Atlantic stablecoin.
Yeah, the Atlantic stablecoin. I don't know, but I thought that was It was a really good question. And I thought it was a compelling answer. I hadn't really heard
somebody talking about that. It is a really good question. I think it is. I do think people are circling back on some of the ideas around like early experiments with micropayments and trying to figure out whether AI is the thing that could remove the friction that was making them tough. Because like I love a metered paywall where you put in your email to read the article, but you can only do that once. So what can you do other times?
Companies,
I don't know. Because I was sitting next to Ben Dietz, friend of the pod, at the Air event, and he flipped his phone over to show me something in Retail Dive, which was like, Birkenstocks is doing so well, they're opening another clog factory.
Wow.
And I was like, where? And it was a Bloomberg article. So he clicked through and he hit the paywall, but it looked like you could do Apple Pay. So I was like, buy the article. And so he's trying to like double click for Apple Pay. Cause I was like, if that works, that's sick. I didn't know that they were doing that.
That'd be awesome.
He was trying to double click just like you do at the freaking subway. And like, cause you just have to have your phone unlocked to swipe in now in the New York City subway. And it didn't work. And I was like, I literally said to him, Ben, solving that, what just happened to you is my life's work. Because if you had been able to pull that up and just double click and pay on Apple Pay for that article, that's clam. That's clam. Like everyone should be able to do that. And there's this new thing that Cloudflare and Base are working on together called the 402 protocol, where they're trying to create a system where AI agents that are crawling the web for information are kind of automatically paying as they go. But my argument is there's always going to need to be some sort of user interface as well, where like we can see what other people are paying for. Like if I'm doing a search through an LLM, I'm definitely happy to know that every source that became an input for that search is being compensated. But I think that there's another piece of the way people understand their taste that requires some sort of user interface for us to be,
that requires agency, if you will.
Agency, yeah, and activity in those decisions, even if some of them are augmented by a programmable wallet or an AI agent working on our behalf. Because then people are going to be like, I want to pay more for the stuff that I really care about beyond the baseline. And that's where that secondary market for AI agents comes in of like, maybe I just want to subscribe to the taste of somebody else and I want to pay them as the intermediary.
One thing, related here, I often think about how with newsletter paywalls, I think are so much better than some of the paywalls of the past, where it used to be very easy to get around, say, a New Yorker paywall in various ways. One of my favorite techniques was, sometimes it still works for some websites, if you load the page and immediately click the X button up by the URL to stop it loading. Sometimes that stops it from loading the paywall. It's a little intel for you. But Beehive, Substack, Ghost, any of these modern newsletter platforms basically like are pretty good at like load, like there's not really a way to get around the paywall. You just simply have to pay. There's no archive.com, whatever. But if you're a paying customer of a newsletter product and you've been paying for a while and then you stop paying, you still have all of those articles, all that content archived in your email, in as much as your, you know, Gmail is an archive and not something that is itself unstable, right? Like, but you could download those emails, you could put them on a hard drive, whatever. So like in the context of, let's say, paying $2, a dollar, whatever it is for a Bloomberg article, do you think it would also archive it in that way? Like, would it email you a copy of it? And then you kind of like have bought this paper?
I mean, it should. Like, I think some of the benefit of having AI paywalls is like, you can have like really specific upsells, right? Like in this instance, it's the friction that was the problem. Like he was willing to pay $1.99 while I was billing him, but like, it wasn't speaking to the Apple Pay. Like if it was speaking to the Apple Pay, like if you remove that friction, then you can do really interesting stuff. Like maybe Ben is getting this deal that's like pay a dollar for this article or $5 for the next 6 months. Oh my God, great deal. I'm just going to pay $5. Yeah. Like, but I'm getting a deal that's like put in your email for free or pay $2 to read this article. And that they could be offering through AI 150 different paywall deals at the same time. That is smart business. The only stupid business is stuff that is not making people pay for stuff. You know, like, right?
Yeah.
That's what I think. There was something else. Oh, well, okay. So Danny and I also kind of treated it like a meeting about creative complaint. So mm-hmm. we kept like running away to a corner to brainstorm. Yeah. But we're really excited. So we're turning Ick into a podcast called Creative Complaint and currently working on getting the art and music set for that. But Danny's going to be hosting. And mm-hmm. I'm honestly shocked that we didn't think of this before, because the idea of being able to come on and talk about stuff that you don't like is so compelling. One of the things that was a challenge for us, though, is I didn't want to use the word hate in the tagline of the show, because I feel like there's so much hate in the political environment right now that I don't want to contribute to it, even if it's just like the stuff that we're talking about that we hate is not people, it's behaviors and stuff. Yeah. So that was something that we had to work around, because obviously hate gets people's attention. And the tagline we ended up coming up with was, I believe, taste told through distaste. So as a result of that, Ben has been referring to Creative Complaint as Distaste Land.
Distaste Land. That's good. That's good.
I think if we did that, that would be too much. And I do like the repetition of Creative Complaint. I also think like Danny, so Creative Complaint is Danny's podcast. We're distributing it at least through the end of the year, but it allows her to potentially take it with her, just like you might do someday with Creator Spotlight. Like,
yeah,
if she needed to. And she could also potentially expand it to be more about the creative process. You know, she could be the Rick Rubin of talking about stuff that you distaste. Mm-hmm. And so I liked that flexibility to like, this is just not like open mic for haters. This is like getting into like, well, why does the stuff that bothers us bother us?
So like therapy.
Like therapy. You know, we have another podcast coming that's a lot more like therapy, but I can't reveal the details.
We'll keep that one under wraps for now. This is an exclusive. That's yet to be scooped. Yes. Actually, I don't know. It might have been scooped already by the time you hear this.
I didn't give it to Mark Stenberg.
Okay.
I spread my scoops around. I'm very generous.
Mm-hmm. That's really sustainable of you.
For the it's like mulch.
Or something.
You have to spread it across the whole garden bed.
Love mulch. I love mulch.
Mulch smells so good. Manure smells so bad. Make that make sense.
You know, I'll exclusively reveal, I do have a nostalgic sense for the smell of manure.
Dude, you're on for grant to go like, sounds to smell like manure.
No, especially it was like my high school.
Pulling it up right now.
My high school, it's kind of like on this hill above the bottoms is what you call it in the town where I'm from, which is like the area like between town and the ocean. That's like the water table's really high, so it's like pasture land and stuff. And so sometimes when the wind was right, you get out of class and it just reeks of manure.
Similar thing, but for driving through Pennsylvania on the way to Ohio, there's a pig stretch, and let me tell you, you do not want to stop there. Do you know about this? I just put in manure as a note in Fragrantica just to see what would come up. And do you know about this perfume Paddock from Hermes? Speaking of Hermes.
Certainly I do not.
All right. The notes, hay, carrot seeds, amber, and grass. But I think somebody must have used the word manure in their, I see. Okay. So they're talking about how this was inspired by some sort of equestrian event that Hermes is involved in, but they left the manure scent out of the perfume itself.
Okay. I think I just remembered from Shane's talk with Nicholas Thompson at the end of the air event. He was talking about, or somebody, I think somebody had asked, no, this was before somebody asked this question. Anyways, he was talking about like the AI race, the AI war between the US and China, and had this way of framing it in terms of like, look, like if if China is purported to win the AI war or vice versa, the US, like, what do you think is going to happen the day before they like figure out AGI? Like, the one country is going to bomb the other, right? Like, if it's really this thing that's like world eating and world.
He said that?
Yeah. 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 Cause I mean, he was like, it's the logical thing. If AGI is really going to like, is the key to like winning everything and becoming super rich, whatever, if one country is about to figure it out, then the other company will just, or the other country will just bomb them. And then he was, you know, walking it back like, okay, from there, like, what do you think is going to happen 1 year before? So I don't remember like if he gave quite a conclusion on this, but what I got from it was that like, it's inevitable that like neither country will like win this AI war as such, because they will like,
well, he's extrapolating based on what was the same thing that happened with nuclear weapons, right?
Yeah.
If somebody's about to have a nuclear weapon, you don't want them to have, you bomb them mm-hmm. with nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
But in an all out scenario, it's not that clear cut, right?
Yeah. He also said he was at some conference or something in Switzerland, and he'd brought his 17-year-old son, and they were having lunch with some like big AI scholar guy, some guy, you know, who is a bigwig teacher or something at some university. Mm-hmm. And anyways, like his son asked the guy, I was like, well, I'm about to go to college. Which college should I pick? Or like, what should I study in college? If we're taking for granted that AGI will soon be a thing. And he recounted the guy saying like, I'll just go to a party school. Like, don't worry. Just go to a party school. Enjoy your time. Like, which I don't know if this guy's politics or like stance on AI is that like, oh, it's going to be this abundance thing and like work is going to be over, which I certainly don't believe. But it was, I don't know, I guess it was just kind of pithy.
I mean, I think go to any school and turn it into a party school. Mm-hmm. That's important to
That's
you.
Kind
any
of
school could be a
do.
Party school. Yeah.
If you're not lame.
Well, I wanted to tell you about this other piece that I have curated on Clone right now. It's from the MIT Press Reader, which I don't know if that's...
I don't know if I've ever read her.
Yeah, well, I know what MIT Press is.
Yeah.
I guess this is what their online presence is called. It's this guy, Daniel Temkin. He's the author of 44 SLangs, The Art of Esoteric Code. And the piece is called The Hacker Folk Art of Esoteric Coding. He's basically talking about folk... Like, it's kind of like the outsider art and folk art equivalent of programs, where some of them have actually been implemented and they're almost like inside jokes among programmers, where it's like code as more of like performance art, but within the environment. So it's not like performance art in the sense of like making a consumer app that only sends the word yo. It's like something that you could only understand if you were also a coder, or if somebody explains the concept to you. And then others are just like kind of ideas. So like, you know how Saul LeWitt, his artwork was instructions for the artwork.
For wall
drawings, so anyone could do the wall drawing. Yeah. So it's kind of the code equivalent of that. And he talks about this coding language that I have actually known about for a bit and been interested by for obvious reasons. So this is, I'm not 100% sure on like, what the definition of ESOLang is. I think it's like, I'm guessing it means code as language. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the first ESOLang I fell in love with, he says, was Piet, which is named for Piet Mondrian. And okay, so it's pronounced Piet. I'm obviously pronouncing that wrong. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Like the ball.
And Piet programs are written as a progression of colors and orthogonally pixelated images resembling mosaics or lo-fi graphics. So I just think that's so cool. I really am so interested in, as a non-technical person, the mixing of code and culture and code and artwork and all the possibilities there. And I really enjoyed reading that. It made me think like I should learn to code just so I can get all these inside jokes.
You know,
vibe coding's not going to give you that.
I did computer science like 101 or 102 or whatever mm-hmm. in school, and it was fun, and sometimes I think back on what could have been. I wouldn't have to be podcasting, right? I'd be rich, maybe, probably not. But what I remember is like the one assignment I remember is like making a flag and making it wave.
Ah.
In like C++ or something. Somebody who's listening to this and like, that's not how you do that. But yeah, I think we were using C++, and I think we were making waving flags.
One of the ideas for the clone t-shirt that I tried to sell Josh on was they have like the C++ instructions for that first Apple processor image, which was where it said like, hello world.
Yes.
Or like, hello. So that's famous because it's like the first thing they showed on the Mac. But I wanted to just print the code instructions for that, like on the back of the shirt.
It would have been fun. I like and that. He was I love like, a no. back of the shirt print.
We decided to do global coffeehouse aesthetic meets POMO instead.
What's POMO?
Postmodern.
Oh.
But
I was thinking like of missing out, like, but what's the P?
Well, factory POMO is technically like purity, it's the thing that kind of looks like the Ayn Rand cover, but there's like some overlapping aesthetic signifiers with the Global Village Coffee House. Cause like Global Village Coffee House still has like those figures that look like a little bit like more like stone figures, but they also have this sort of like pipe player stick figure guys. Mm-hmm. Anyway, like it was all good. Sort of so happening sick. In the same era. Oh my God, Life is Good. I found my Life is Good Daisy hat the other day.
Oh, sick.
Yeah, I still have that. I'll wear it on the pod at some point.
I just bought Emma an old Life is Good shirt on eBay. Speaking of buying.
I love that it's like on eBay. Old enough that that's like a camp that it's cool thing now. To wear now.
In elementary school, I was dripping in Life is Good. That was like for like Christmas. I got like
Life out? Is Good
t-shirt. I was dripping.
Were you Life dripped out good. In Big Dog? Big no, Dog's gotten really political.
No Big Dog. No, I was my drip was my drip was khakis. This is elementary school, mind you.
Yeah.
Khakis, Life is Good long sleeve shirts. I didn't wear a short sleeve shirt to school until fifth grade, and then a fleece vest. That was the drip.
Can we call this episode Dripped Out and Life is Good?
Dripped
Life
Out
is good, Life is Good. Life is Good Drip.
Life is good drip. Life is Good Drip.
That's really funny.
Should we end it there? Life is Good.
Life.
Drip. Life is Good, semicolon, drip.
This has been Dripland. Thank you for listening.
See you next week.